Rocks! Rocks! It's always rocks!
The strong young man's muscular bare arms glistened with sweat. He was tall, more than halfway between 6 and 7 feet, and though he had lost considerable weight on this multi-year journey, he did not appear skinny, and he was certainly not frail. His lean muscles rippled taut and strong. A mop of blonde hair covered his head, bespeaking his vanguard heritage, and he wore a scraggly beard, for even though his superiors disapproved of it, they would not enforce their rules against facial hair when they possessed no implement to easily be rid of it. He stood on a slope of brown dirt and gray stones, fewer near him now, since he had already tossed scores over the ridge so that they would roll and bounce down near to the wall the man and his companions were repairing. He hoisted another one, brought it near his shoulder, and heaved it out. It didn't quite make the lip, and began to roll back his way. He intercepted it with a few fast strides, planting his foot against it and holding it in place before it could gain any real momentum.
Catch your breath, Brother Cormac. The air is particularly warm this day.
Cormac gathered up his heavy woolen robes and pulled them over his head, leaving him naked other than a bulky white loincloth.
Brother Cormac!
Always rocks. Ever since we came to this cursed island, we've done nothing more than pile rocks.
Cursed?
Giavno wore an expression of utter disappointment.
We were sent north to Frozen Alpinador to begin a chapel, brother, for the glory of Blessed Abel. Will you call that cursed?
Cormac shook his head helplessly. They had departed Chapel Pelennor in Vanguard more than 3 years before, all full of excitement and a sense of great purpose. They were to travel to the fierce mountainous northland of Alpinador, home of the pagan barbarians, and spread the word of Blessed Abel. They would save souls with their gemstone magic and the truth and beauty of their message. But they had found only battle and outrage, and their every word had sounded as insult to the proud and strong Northmen. Running for their lives more than proselytizing, the band had become lost in short order and had stumbled and bumbled their way along for weeks with the freezing winter closing in all around them. Surely the nearly 20 monks and their like number of servants would have found a cold and empty death, but they had happened upon this place, a huge lake of warm waters and perpetual steam, a place of islands small and large. Father de Gilb, who led their expedition, proclaimed it a miracle and decided that here, on these waters, they would fulfill their mission and build their chapel.
Rocks.
Cormac bent low and picked up the heavy stone again, this time heaving it far over the ridgeline.
The lake teems with fish and food. Have you ever tasted water so...
Giavno launched into another long sermon about the duties of a monk of Abel, the sacrifices expected, and the reward awaiting them all when they had slipped the bonds of their mortal coils. He recited from the great book at length, but Cormac heard none of it, for he had his own litany against the despair, an unsought but surely found reprieve, one that he hoped would bring him the greater answers of this muddling road called life. She glided from a boat as the boat glided ashore, and with equal grace, her movements as fluid as the gently lapping waves. The moon, Sheila, was almost full this night and hung in the sky behind and above Michaela, softening her image further. She wore few clothes, as was normal for everyone on the hot lake of Mithranidun, other than the monks and their heavy woolen robes. Cormac felt his heavy robe about him now, and he became almost self-conscious of it, for it felt inappropriate in the soft, warm, misty breeze. Michaela's hand went to her hip as she moved toward him, and she untied her short skirt and let it fall aside. Still walking, she pulled her top over her head. She was not embarrassed, not uncomfortable, just beautiful and nude. Other than the necklaces of trinkets, shells and claws and teeth strung about her neck, and a bracelet and anklet of the same design. A large feather was braided into her hair. It was the first time Cormac had seen her naked, but it felt no more intimate to him than the last time they had been together at the great meeting between the shamans of Michaela's tribe, Jan Osum, and a few select brothers of Chapel Isle. That's when he had known, and when she had known. That's when Cormac had found a witness to his life, a justification of his heart and mind, a spirit kindred, a heart equally wide. All of the bantering, all of the posturing between the shamans and the monks had played out like a sorry game to him, a juggling of positions with each side trying to gain the better ground. None of it had impressed him, and none of it had impressed Michaela, and both had recognized the truth of it all, in each other's eyes. So now she walked toward him with confidence, and all that she had revealed since stepping from the boat paled against that which she had already shown him. He looked at her eyes, at the sense of purpose on her face, at the trust that had already grown between them. He fumbled with his robe. He wished he could have been as graceful as Michaela, but sensations overwhelmed him now, and a sense of urgency came over him. They fell together on the sandbar and said not a word as they made love under the stars and moon. Each had seen the potential of something greater in joining their religions, a wider and more perfect truth, and so it was physically between them, where their union seemed a more perfect form than either alone.
"Do you not agree, Brother Cormac?"
Cormac realized that it wasn't the first time Giavno had asked him that.
"The glories of Blessed Abel will be great when the tribes of this lake are brought into our love."
Their traditions are centuries old."
"Patience."
Cormac looked over at his Abelican brother, then followed the older monk's wide-eyed stare to the water behind them. He saw the Powrys, bandy-legged, bandy-armed, barrel-chested dwarves floating in on their flat raft just an instant before they began springing into the water near the shore, bursting into a wild charge, brandishing their weapons. Cormac whirled about, took a few running strides, and leaped high into the air, crashing into a pair of dwarves before they cleared the surf. One went down, the other staggered back, and Cormac set himself quickly and launched in a circle kick.
"Out! Hold on, my shoulder, drown you!"
Giavno thrust forth his hand and loosed the power of the stone he clutched, graphite. Cormac sloshed toward the rocky shore with all the strength he could muster. He pivoted as he went and managed to somewhat deflect the barrage of clubs that came spinning his way.
"To me!"
When Cormac reached his companion, he skidded low, grabbed up a stone, and turned as he rose, launching it at the nearest pursuer. Cormac didn't retreat. In fact, he surprised the dwarf by coming forward. The dwarf wrapped his strong arms around Cormac's waist and drove him to the side, intent upon bearing him to the ground. The monk worked his legs frantically, trying to stay upright, and repeatedly hit the creature with his pumping right hand. The monk didn't relent, though, nor did the Powry, taking him far from Brother Giavno and the other two monks and the group of a half dozen Powrys bearing down on them. The lead dwarf fell over. The other five rumbled past, ignoring the rock missiles, and the club fight began in earnest. Cormac scored a solid, stunning hit, but square dwarf teeth clamped upon the side of his hand and bit down hard. Cormac thrashed and tore free his hand.
"Yuck, but I'm to scrape the skin from your pretty face!
A trio of stinging left jabs put the dwarf back on his heels. Giavno swung hard with his makeshift wooden mace. The monk wrapped his arm over the dwarf's hands and bore in hard against his enemy. Giavno slammed against the dwarf, who didn't budge an inch. His advantage, the length of his arms, was lost, and the Powry fast squirmed and twisted free its hands, clamping them about Giavno's waist and tugging him along as it fell into a roll. Giavno grimaced through the pain and managed to turn about to see the two companions nearest him, both fighting valiantly and fiercely against a trio of dwarves. At one point in the roll, the dwarf loosened his grip, and Giavno quickly set his feet and thrust forward, scrambling toward his friends. As he had hoped, one of the Powrys broke away to intercept, launching a flying tackle at the monk and bearing him back to the two pursuing dwarves. Still clutching his graphite stone, the Powrys fell back, were thrown back, and Giavno sprinted for his companions.
"Your blood will make me, Bally, shine all the brighter then!"
The dwarf brought his staff up above his head, leaping forward. Cormac dived down to the side, bending his knee and bringing his other leg back in at the back of the dwarf's knees. That was not but a ruse, though, as the unfortunate dwarf soon learned. For McCormack rolled out farther to the side, then reversed his flow, throwing his hips over and locking his scissors grip on the dwarf. Cormac continued to roll to his back, extracting his legs on the last turn. He arched, put his feet under him, and snapped his muscles, lifting him to a standing position over the prone dwarf. He moved fast into position, where he could stomp the Powry's face into the stone. He turned in time to see the charge of the first dwarf he had decked out in the water. It came out with fury. No, not fury, Cormac realized, but with terror. For behind it emerged another creature, its smooth, bluish, almost translucent skin gleaming in the dull and hazy light, its black eyes peering at its prey intently under a protruding brow. A glacial troll. No taller than the dwarves and far lighter, the glacial trolls were nevertheless the bane of all the island societies. Their thin limbs were deceptively strong, and their teeth pointed like little knives.
Trolls! Trolls! Faster!
The dwarf threw his head back as he broke free of the surf and seemed to come on more quickly. Momentarily, though, for when the Powry jerked again, Cormac saw the truth of it. The dwarf staggered forward, slowing, then slumped down to his knees. That call had all the Powrys pausing and turning as the truth of their predicament fell fully on the man and dwarf alike. 10 of them stood against more than a dozen of the trolls, who were armed with spears tipped with sharpened barbed shells and not the relatively benign sticks that the island inhabitants generally used to batter each other about the skulls. The trolls closed on the kneeling Bickelbryn, but so did Cormac, leaping down across the stones in full charge. The glacial trolls neared, reaching for their embedded spears. Cormac put on a burst of speed, closing ground, and leaped, turning himself sidelong in midair as he cleared the dwarf. He was over the spears before the trolls could fully retract them. Cormac rolled sidelong right off the two, who scrambled and bit at him, one catching a tooth on his bare forearm. Cormac tugged that arm free immediately and managed to slam it down hard on the troll's face for good measure as he regained his balance. Cormac jumped back, 3 on him now, and a 4th coming in. One of the trolls he had bowled over stumbled forward and to the ground. Behind it came the furious Powry, running headlong and empty-handed, for he had thrown his staff, spear-like, into the back of the fallen troll's head. He ran right past his wounded friend, leaping onto the 2nd of the trolls Cormac had tackled, bearing it down under his thrashing and kicking form. Cormac stomped hard on the back of the neck of the first fallen troll, ending its squirming. Up on the ridge, all of the Powrys had disengaged from Cormac's Abelican brethren and were charging down. Cormac grabbed up one of the fallen troll's spears, stabbing at another of the creatures. The troll scrambled and thrashed, slapped and squirmed, but to no avail, and Cormac fell atop it again. Cormac rolled to see the other troll, the one hit in the back of the head by the thrown Powry staff, standing over him, a rock in hand. Cormac found his sensibilities just enough to punch out. Cormac tried to straighten, staggering left and right. He saw the Powrys and the trolls, one big pile of confusion and fury. Then he saw the ground rushing up to swallow him. He thought of Michaela, his secret lover, and was sad to know that he would not rendezvous with her that night at their special place on the sandbar to the north as they had planned. He thought it silly that he thought of that at all, for he didn't know why that image of the beautiful barbarian had flooded his thoughts at this critical time. Then he knew the reason. The thought, the image, were a blessing, a moment of peace in a roiling storm. The light disappeared in a blink, taking her beautiful form with it, and Cormac drowned in a cold and empty darkness. Branson rolled off Kay Dale and onto his back. He threw his arm up over his face and even miscalculated that action, thumping himself hard on the forehead. Tears of frustration welled in his eyes, and with much trembling and shaking, he managed to guide his arm down to cover them. Kaydale came up to her side on one elbow to look over him. In ultimate frustration, the man managed to clasp the soul stone which lay at his side.
I love you.
You would have to suffer my clumsiness.
We knew that would take time.
It will take forever, and I do not improve. I dared believe that by now I would be free of the soul stone. I dared hope.
It takes time. I remember the stork who could hardly walk. You can walk now without the stone tied to your head. You have improved.
Old news. My improvements were dramatic and I dared to hold hope. But they have stopped now. Without the stone, I am a clumsy oaf.
No.
Without the stone, I cannot even make love to my wife. I am no man.
God.
What?
I am unused to the highwayman so full of self-pity. You have brought down a laird and robbed the Prince of Delaval twice. You are a hero of the folk.
Who cannot make love to my wife.
You make love to me all the time.
With a gemstone bound to my forehead. Without it, I am too clumsy.
Then be glad that you have it.
I want.
And you will find it. In time. But if you do not, then so be it. Be glad that we have the soul stone. Indeed, I am. But even if we didn't have it, even if you could not make love to me with any grace, do you believe that it would affect the way I feel about you? Do you think it would diminish my love and adoration for you? If I could not make love to you, would you throw me from your life to find a whole woman? Of course you would not. If I believed you could, I would never have agreed to marry you. I love you, Branson. The physical act of making love is sweet to me, with or without the gemstone upon your head. There is no more to be said, and no more of your self-pity, if you please. I cannot suffer it for my beloved, who could kill a dragon protecting me. You have steeped yourself so far above the common man that self-pity from you is worse than irony. It is foolhardy and laughably ridiculous. You are the highwayman. You are the best man I have ever known. A better does not exist. You are my husband, and every day I awaken and thank God and the Ancient Ones that Branson Garibond found his way into my life.
She's not the like this.
Dawson McKeague shot the hunched old grump an incredulous look.
They're all dead.
The man swept his arm out to the smoking ruins that had been a thriving town only a few days before.
How could anyone like this, old fool? Men and women and children of Vanguard. Our brethren. Our fellows slaughtered before us by the monstrous plague.
Goblins and them wretched blue trolls, and without Pinador and backing, not to doubt.
Dawson could only nod. The war had grown all about the northern frontier of Vanguard, and now, if this was any indication, it had snuck in around the edges. For this burned and broken town, Tethmall by name, sat closer to the Gulf of Corona than to the battlefields in the north. The 15 men of the expedition turned as one to regard the procession galloping down the road. The elite guards of Castle Pelennor led the way and took up the rear, sandwiching a trio of monks dressed in their brown robes, a pair of advisors lightly armored and armed, and two women who both seemed at ease on their respective mounts, riding hard and not in the side saddle manner, which had become fashionable among the courtesans of the holding south of the Gulf of Corona. One of those women, the taller of the two, with hair going silver, but her shoulders still tall and straight, held the attention of the onlookers most of all.
She should not be out of the castle.
The procession rambled up to the edge of the town, the soldiers fanning out into defensive positions while the seven dignitaries trotted up to Dawson and the others.
Milady Guaidra.
Guaidra rolled her leg easily over her mount and dropped to the ground.
They fought well.
They are all dead?
We've found none alive.
Then it was no small force that came against them. How was such a sizable group able to sneak so far south?
Samhaste magic.
Guaidra seemed more annoyed than impressed with the monk's statement.
It is a wild land, my lady. We are not populous. Our roads are hardly guarded, and even if they were, a short trek through the forest would bypass any sentries.
And their determination is aggravating.
As always, Dawson was impressed by how in control and command Dame Guidra remained. She carried an aura of competence around her, one that had initially surprised many of Castle Pelennor's court. For Guidra had been just a young girl that quarter of a century before when her father, Laird Gendron, already a widower, had been killed unexpectedly in a fall from his horse while hunting. Gendron, revered by the folk of this northern wilderness known as Vanguard, had held the scattered and disparate communities together with a warm fist, as the saying had gone. A saying applied to Gendron, to his father before him, and to his great-uncle who had been Laird of Pelennor before that.
I cannot tolerate this. Chapel Pelennor's fall has created unrest, and the folk will be all the more unnerved when news of Tethmall's fate spreads through the forest trails.
You fear they will question the fortitude of their dame.
Do you remember when Laird Gendron died?
I was with you when we received the news. Aye. And so began the whispers, the laments of why hadn't the Laird sired a son?
The lower their voices, the louder they sounded. Those voices were part of the reason I so abruptly agreed to marry Peter.
He was my friend, as he was your husband. I suspect that he, too, heard those whispers and couldn't suffer to see his beloved Guidra so pained.
I was a young woman, barely more than a girl. And never in my life had I done anything that would have or should have inspired their confidence. Even those years later, when Peter died, their doubts about me rightfully lingered.
That was 15 years ago, my lady. And before your 30th birthday. Do you fear that they still doubt you?
We are in a desperate war.
It is Vanguard! We are always at one war or another. The woods are full of goblins. The coast crawling with powries, the Northland thick with trolls, and never in my life have I met a more disagreeable bunch than those Alpinadoran barbarians.
This is different, Dawson.
Her tone quieted the man more than her words, for there lay a truth there that neither could deny. Dame Guidra had taken a lover and a Bellican brother, and in the 2 years of her tryst, that particular church's stature had grown considerably throughout her holding and, by extension, throughout Vanguard, much to the dismay and open anger of the dangerous and powerful Samhastes.
You fell in love?
Foolishly. I placed my heart above my responsibilities, and all the land suffers for it.
Those same churches were going to fight, with or without your actions. As they fight a proxy war through the lairds in the south, where, it is said, 300 men die every day.
There will be more Tethmalls. One community after another will be sacked.
I beg you not to tell that to your subjects, milady.
My council with Chief Donna Marga did not go well.
Guidra referred to the powerful leader of the one particularly friendly Alpinadorian tribe with whom the men of Vanguard often traded and who many times had graced Guidra's table at Castle Pelennor.
He will likely keep his clan out of the fighting.
That is good news. His warriors are fierce.
But he will not intervene on our behalf with the other tribes.
Samhaste's influence is great among the Alpinadorans. But great enough to keep them allied with the ugly goblins and the light-skinned trolls?
We are losing, and Donna Marga is a pragmatic man. If Vanguard is to be sanctioned by the victors, then he would not serve his clan well to be left out of that gain.
Vanguard is land. Without us, it is empty land. What good will it alone bring to the Alpinadorans? What point is this war?
Guidra nodded her complete understanding. The Samhastes, so they believed, were egging on the monsters and the barbarians, but the underlying logic told Guidra and her advisors that ancient Baden didn't really want to wipe the Vanguardsmen from the region and chase refugees back across the Gulf of Corona.
Ancient Baden and his disciples do not wish to minister to goblins and trolls, nor the barbarians of Alpinador, who loyally follow their own gods.
Gods not far removed from the Samhaste deities.
Oh, true enough. But would you expect Dunamarga and the other chiefs to relinquish their control to Baldin's miserable priests? Of course they will not.
Then this whole war is to teach me a lesson.
It is to drive the Abelicans back across the waters and secure vanguard for the Samhastes. We, all of us, indeed even Dame Gwydra, are caught in the middle of a war of religions. And it won't end with Vanguard if Baden drives the Abelican south. He knows that Laird Ethelbert and Laird Delaval have thrown in fully with the Abelicans. And it's not to his liking. He will chase the monks from Vanguard, then use us to cross the gulf and assail Chapel Abel itself. Begging your pardon, dear woman, but that's no fight I'm wanting.
We must force upon ancient Baden that wider fight you believe he desires. Before the battleground is his for the choosing.
An immigrant army.
It is a fine season for the folk of Haunts to turn their eyes to the open and beautiful north, I think. Palmaris Town, from all reports, has become the haven of rats and foul odors, and there are rumors that the refugees of the war collect en masse at Chapel Abel, where there is little excess shelter and supplies. And yet we have villages already built and ready to house those who would seek a better life. And a land as bountiful as any in Corona.
Villages empty because all the men are fighting the war, or are already planted in the ground.
It is the way of things. A man who comes here to fight for Gwydra is fighting too for his future. If he remains in the south, he will be swept into Delaval's army, or Ethelbert's, into a war whose outcome will have no bearing on the prosperity or security of his family. What will change for the folk of Palmaris Town, or any other town, if Ethelbert wins? If Delaval wins? They are two lairds of the same cloth. Their fight is one for personal gain and not over any manner of governance. But up here, the battle has more meaning. Up here, my warriors strike hard at the flesh of goblins and glacial trolls.
And men.
Barbarians. Not the brethren of the men of Haunts, as we see in the south. Not a brother, perhaps, who through mere circumstance moved into a town now serving the other side. The gulf is calm, and the ships are waiting.
Chapel Abel?
That would be a fine place to start. The brothers there know of our desperation, and they do not wish to have a powerful Baden ruling Vanguard unopposed. Let them direct you to towns not yet emptied by Delaval's press crews.
If Laird Delaval learns of my actions in stealing his potential soldiers...
Do not let him know.
Dawson smiled hopelessly. When Dame Gwydra made up her mind, it was not to be easily changed.
They will come. You will convince them.
He fell down for the fourth time. Kaedale ran toward him, but Branson stubbornly waved her off. Trembling every inch of the way, he managed to get over onto his belly and up to his knees. They were on the road north of Delaval, heading north-northwest along the bank of the majestic waterway that had recently been named the Maeser Delaval. Though this northeastern bank was considered the civilized side of the river, the road, or trail actually, hardly showed any such signs. They were only 3 days out from Delaval town in a region untouched by the war, yet it was hard to call their path a road. Uneven, muddy, and littered with the large roots of the great willows that lined the river, the trail could trip up any but the most careful traveler. Every step proved a test of courage for Branson, who stubbornly carried his soul stone in his pouch and not even in his hand, let alone strapped to his forehead. Resting on his hands and knees to reorient and catch his breath, Branson fought the urge to slip his hand into his pouch and produce the gemstone. He noticed a pool of red liquid and only then realized that he had slammed his nose on that last fall, splitting his lip as well.
Don't you think that's enough for today?
Kaedale grabbed his flailing hand and gently guided it to the pouch and the gemstone, then helped him bring the stone to his forehead.
We've barely covered 2 miles.
We should try to cross another 5 before dusk. We'll not go another single mile at our pace, and if you truly injure yourself...
Branson turned his head to eye her hard.
I understand, and I know your reasoning. I wouldn't dare pretend that I have the right to disagree, but I beg of you to measure your pace, my love. You're tormenting your body more than it can take. You'll need more than the Soul Stone if you break your knee. And where will that leave me and my ma?
My patience has long gone with this creature known as the Stork.
But mine is not.
Still holding the gemstone tight against his forehead, Branson leapt to his feet, catching himself surely and with incredible agility. Branson pulled the gemstone away. Immediately he swayed. He stubbornly put his gemstone back in his pouch and let it go. He took a step, awkward and unsteady. He nearly fell over, but he did not, and he even managed to glance back at Kay Dale to see her and her concerned mother exchanging frowns. Hand shaking, arm flailing, Branson managed to get his fingers back around the precious gemstone. He brought it forth and collected, too, the black silk bandana he used to secure it to his forehead.
I did not wish to end with a stumble. I will be as patient as I can.
I love you.
With or without the gemstone?
You are better than you were before you found the Soul Stone. This ground trips you up, perhaps, but in your youth, the flat grass of the monastery courtyard often left you on your face.
Ki Chi Kree.
The promise of the Jester, too. You will overcome this infirmity. You already have. You defeated it with your spirit long before you found any real control of your limbs. To others, you were the Stork, some in jest and some in earnest sympathy. But you have always been Branson, and you will always be Branson. With or without the Soul Stone, whether or not you need the Soul Stone to walk a broken trail.
I never knew my real father. He studied the Jester too. He has been to the Walk of Clouds. He copied their book. The same book that Garibald taught to me when I was young. He will have the answers.
Or he will show you where to look for them.
Garibald told me that he went to Chapel Abel in the north. If I can find him...
Bran Denard was a good man. I owe him my life as surely as I owe it to Senwi. He knew why I was put out on the road to die, and why I carried the bites of the serpent. He knew that his superiors in his church had witnessed my execution, and had, with their silence, condoned it. And still, he fought for me against the vicious Powries, and he hid me away at great personal peril. You are much like him, Branson. You carry his integrity and his sense of justice. Physical strength is nothing when weighed against that.
I will find my physical strength. It is there. The Soul Stone shows it to me. I will overcome this infirmity.
I would never doubt you. And double blessed am I to have been saved by your father and again by you, the highwayman.
Kay Dale walked over and took Branson's arm.
5 miles.
That would make 7 for the day. And we will do 7 tomorrow.
2 without the gemstone?
2.5.
The light was the sun sparkling off the water. The taste in his mouth was sand, for he was face down on the beach. With great effort, Cormac rolled his head to the side. The bloody-capped dwarves were huddled in a circle, their arms locked over the shoulders of the next dwarf in the ring. They turned their living wheel in perfect cadence, a few steps left, a few back to the right. Cormac tried to lift his head to get a better perspective, and only then did the monk realize that he had been tightly bound, his hands painfully drawn up against his back, the rough weeds tight into his wrists. Cormac realized only then that the dwarves were circling a particular spot, a particular thing. As he considered the words of their ditty, he solved the riddle, but he held his tongue, not wanting to risk interrupting the solemn ceremony. It went on for a long while until finally the ring of dwarves opened, revealing a cairn of piled stones. The dwarves turned as one so that they were no longer shoulder to shoulder, but formed instead a single file as they marched around and then away from the grave of their fallen comrade.
Oh, are you awake then? I was thinking you meant to sleep the whole of the day.
Better for him if he did, what? Better for him if he'd listened to us fellas and done run to their home of rocks.
More fun for us that he didn't.
Cormac tried to hold steady his breathing, tried not to be afraid as he glanced all around for his Abelican brethren, but they were not to be seen. They were in the rock chapel, as the dwarf had proclaimed, and Cormac couldn't even free his arms to defend himself. The serrated blade was barely an inch from Cormac's throat when another dwarf grabbed the arm holding it.
Nah! I won't cut him wrong that his blood's spilling too fast. Let him die slow, and we'll all get our caps in the puddle, what?
Nah, you're not for cutting him at all.
What are you jabbering about, then? I come here to wet me cap, and wetting me cap's what I'm to do.
You got a dozen dead trolls for cotton.
Bah, but troll blood's not much for brightening me cap. And you're knowing it, you danged fool, McQuiggick.
It's the best you're to get, unless some of them other monks come out of their rock houses, and that ain't for happening.
A second dwarf stepped forward in support of McQuiggick. Cormac recognized this one as the wounded Bicklebrin, whom Cormac had circle-kicked under the surf and had later leaped over when he had gone to intercept the ice trolls.
Let him go, Pragonog. If me thoughts are sorting out right, then this one saved me, Harry Bum.
Trolls had you dead. We'd have put you under a stone pile like we done to Reg Wignall there.
Aye.
To Cormac's horror, that powery held up a heart. Regwegno's heart, apparently.
And now you're telling me that I lost half me beard for nothing? And when there's bright human blood right there, laid out and tied already for the taking.
Foul chaps, we'd be to kill one what saved our hairy buns.
He flattened your own fat nose.
Aye. Got a wicked punch on him.
And a wicked kick. Then a good kill it'll be. And brighter the cap I'll wear.
But you weren't the one to drop him, was ya? Trolls bringing him down, and only because he leaped into the lot of them to save Bicklebrin. The least you can do is knock him down yourself afore you're for taking his bright blood, now don't you think?
What are you saying?
McQuiggick grinned, his teeth shining white between the bushy black hair of his beard. He drew out his own knife and stepped fast behind McCormick. With a sudden swipe, he took the bindings from the fallen man's wrists. He reached down and grabbed the man by the arm and roughly hoisted him to his feet. Cormac couldn't focus his eyes and would have fallen back to the sand had not Bicklebrin rushed over to help McQuiggick keep him upright.
We're all righty then.
McQuiggick didn't even have to intercept, though, as a pair of dwarves behind Pragonog grabbed him by the shoulders.
Not now, you dolt. Fool monk can't even stand.
Where's your honor?
It's staining me beret.
Now, buddy yourself.
McQuiggick turned Cormac to face him.
New moon tonight, old Sheila's not to be found. Are you hearing me, boy? Next time Sheila's not to be found, you get yourself back to the beach, and we'll come ashore so that you can fight Pragonag here straight up.
Yeah, but the human dog's not to come out and fight.
McQuiggick tossed his fellow dwarf a dismissive glance.
It's the best you're getting. You come alone and come ready to fight, and if Pragonag's beating you, they know that your blood's forfeit.
And what if this one wins?
We'll get him something for his trouble, then.
Yuck, but you're giving him his life now. Ain't that to be enough?
Aye, that's enough.
Nah, making it more interesting. If this skinny human's to win, then we'll give him Pragonak's cap.
Aye!
To the dactyls, Bermyar!
Are you saying that you can't take a skinny human one-to-one?
Yeah.
You hear it, old boy? Next time Sheila's not to be seen, it gives you a month to get your head put back together. You come out, and you come out alone.
Surely the world was spinning and Cormac hardly registered any of it, but he managed to nod. McQuiggick and Bicklebrin laid him back down on the sand, and Cormac's thoughts fell far, far away. Onlookers ignorant of the shamanistic ways would have thought it a dance, though a pretty one, to be sure. Michaela's bare feet scraped across the sand, drawing lines in a prescribed pattern about her as she turned and swayed. This was the circle of power. Michaela's hands moved in unison a foot apart out to her left. She dug her toe into the sand, connecting her to the power of the earth below her. The energy lifted more easily this time, she felt in her soul, so when her hands were high in the sky, she turned about the other way and slowly turned her palms over as she found a stance of symmetry. She felt the wind gathering in her palms, so she slowly lowered them down by her sides, her thumbs tapping her hips, and then moving lower to brush her bare legs below the hem of her short skirt. They pressed down past the outside of her knees and the sides of her shins as she dropped into a crouch, so low that her hand soon rested flat on the ground. The shaman pressed the power of the wind into the soil, fanning the flames of the lava she had coaxed from far, far below. The ground around her, within her drawn circle, began to steam and to bubble. Despite what she had told herself before beginning the ceremony, Michaela couldn't resist sending her thoughts into the ruby that hung on the gemstone necklace. She felt the power there, teeming with strength, and sent it, too, into the ground. One vent popped clear, shooting hot mist several feet into the air to the approving nod of the gathered clansmen and women. Several grabbed their pails of fish, knowing that the cooking circle was near completion. Michaela felt the warmth beneath her bare hand and knew that she had done well.
Permit the shaman youth!
When she heard those words from her mentor, Tanike, she felt more guilt than pride, for that was her title. The prime shaman of youth, the most promising priest of her generation. She had earned that honor honestly, she knew, and was well on her way to the accolade before the southern monks had ever come to Mithranadun. But the fact that she had dared use an Abelican gemstone in this sacred ritual, or that she wore the necklace at all, or that she had given her heart to a man not of Yan Osum, made Tanike's prideful remarks sting. Lost in a swirl of thoughts, Michaela realized that she should step out of the cooking circle when her feet grew very, very hot. She came out facing the water and walked through the gathering down to the surf.
Always this beach. This is Michaela's special beach.
Michaela didn't turn to face him, for she knew that she was blushing fiercely. This particular beach faced Chapel Isle, and also faced the secret sandbar where she met with her lover.
The magic is strong here, do you think?
Yes, shaman.
Oh, it is the magic of the old gods that draws you to this spot ever again, is it not? I see it, Tupermeda Shaman Yut.
Despite herself, she lifted her gaze toward Chapel Isle, but only for the briefest moment before turning to face Tanike. His knowing smile reminded her of her own whenever she chanced to catch some of the younger boys staring at her legs or breasts.
A place of magic.
Michaela felt her cheeks flush hot again. She glanced over to see the fishermen and their wives preparing the meal, cooking the catch in the circle she had magically prepared by calling to the gods of old Yan Osum, and by extracting the power of the Abelican ruby. The settlement on the mouth of the river where it spilled into the Gulf of Corona was called Palmaris Town. It seemed to Branson, Kaedale, and Callan that this was really two distinct cities and not one. Indeed, a solid wooden fence ran the length of the town, separating the ramshackle hovels in the region of the docks and the Great River from the larger and more comfortable homes of the town's eastern section. That secure fence surrounded the entire town completely, with an open gate accepting the southern road from Delaval and a second one in the northeast running inland just south of the gulf. Guards walked their stations along a parapet built within that fence, with most concentrating in the west, looking out over the town's poor section and the bustling docks. And they were indeed bustling, Branson and his companions noted, as they neared the southern gate. Ferries moved continually across the wide river, and so many sailing ships, including many of Laird Delaval's warships, were in port that several had to be moored out from the fully occupied wharves. Teams of dirty men moved to and fro, heavy ropes out behind them as they hauled skids laden with supplies, or thick trunks of trees brought in from across the river to the west, the region appropriately known as the Timber Lane. Drivers cracked whips on the heels of those poor laborers. The trio of visitors at the gate watched in astonished horror as one man fell to the docks beneath the weight of a heavy punch. He hit the ground, and the dockmaster began kicking him and stomping on him.
You haven't the stomach for it, then?
The gate guard spoke to the trio, obviously noting their horrified expressions. He looked at Branson mostly, who moved without the soul stone this day in full stork disguise.
My husband, wounded in the war in the land south of Delaval.
Fighting for?
Laird Delaval, of course. We are of Pride Town, and Laird Pride threw in with Delaval against Ethelbert as his successor, Laird Delaval's own nephew.
Welcome, then. You've nothing the Abelican monks cannot fix.
I...
None have helped, though many have tried. Perhaps here we will find our answers.
Father Mouskinner is mighty with the stones. Come through then and find your way. And don't worry, those fools down there under the whip were brought from Ethelbert's lines.
They are prisoners?
Until they die from their efforts, aye.
The guard glanced down at the docks and the bedraggled slaves.
I lost my brother in a ship fight in the Gulf. I'd go down there and put the sword to the lot of them if it was my choice to make. But I'll take my satisfaction in knowing that these fools are helping Laird Delaval put an end to Ethelbert's claims. Every log they bring in from across the river, every crate of food or weapons sailing up from Delaval town, works against the Beast of Entel. When Ethelbert falls, and fall he will, I'll take my satisfaction in knowing that Palmeris town played her part in his demise.
I only wish that my husband had not been so badly wounded that he might still aid in the effort.
Of all the towns they had traveled through, none possessed the energy of Palmeris town. The city was not on the front lines of the fighting like so many of the settlements from Pride to Delaval, and few wounded came through. Yet Palmeris town remained in the very center of it all, for through here came many of Laird Delaval's soldiers, boarding ships to be carried across the Gulf of Corona to the distant eastern reaches known as the Mantis Arm. Here in Palmeris town, the war was very real but very distant, an exciting event to be discussed in every tavern and on every street corner, but without the torn bodies and missing limbs that cast the pall of harsh reality. That sanitized reality reflected in the eagerness and excitement of the townsfolk. As word spread down the lanes before the trio, many salutes and bows came at Branson from afar. They secured a tavern room quite easily, offered it half the normal price to the wounded soldier, and set out to find a stable and buyer for Dooley, for the old donkey had seen too much of the road. Whispers preceded them, however, and before they even had the time to walk from the inn to the hitching post to retrieve Dooley, they were met by a smiling young Abelican monk.
Greetings, my friends. I am told that this poor man here has suffered terribly in service to Laird Delaval. May Blessed Abel guide him to kingship.
He was wounded south of Delaval against the men of Ethelbert, yes.
I am Brother Fartus of the Chapel of Precious Memories. Father Malskinner bade me to come forth and find this hero who walks among us. And to offer...
Fartus paused and reached into a belt pouch, producing a quartet of grey soul stones.
You would bestow healing to my poor son-in-law? His wounds are grievous.
As I see. From the manner of his walk, I mean, as I have not witnessed any wound as of yet.
Well, the wound itself is long healed, but the damage remains.
A spear?
No.
Sword?
No.
Dagger?
A club. He was smashed across the back, he told me, and he's had little control of his legs and feet since, and even his voice is lost to us, stuttering as he does.
May I?
Oh, please, brother.
Fartus closed his hand over the gemstones and gripped them so tightly that his knuckles whitened. He put his other hand up to Branson's forehead and began to channel the soothing power of the gemstones into the wounded young man. Branson closed his eyes and steadied immediately, basking in the warmth of the wonderful enchantment. This monk was strong, he recognized immediately, more so than any of the brothers at Chapel Pride. The healing energy flowed pure and direct, and Branson felt as if he had his own stone strapped across his forehead. Using his gesture training, Branson opened up to this sensation and even dared hope, albeit fleetingly, that Brother Fartus might offer some permanent benefit. A few heartbeats later, Fartus relented and removed his warm and trembling palm.
Thank you.
Branson smiled and nodded, standing straighter, for indeed he felt much better, although he knew already it would be a very temporary sensation.
It is a fine thing you did this day.
The wound is profound.
Yes, as many of your brethren have told us. You performed very well, brother. I've not seen him so straight since before the wound.
Already, though, Branson began to bend, a bit of drool dripping from his mouth.
It will not hold. You must bring him to the Chapel of Precious Memories. I will beg Father Mouskinner to allow others to participate. Our combined powers will lengthen the healing, I am certain.
Of course.
Before Parvispus tomorrow.
Fartus referred to the ceremony of twilight.
We'll be out all the day offering our services to the brave men on the docks.
The slaves of war. Indeed, we saw them at their labors being beaten like dogs.
The filth of Ethelbert. Nay, not them, surely. Nay, nay, good lady, I speak of the privateers.
Privateers?
Free men, beholden to neither Ethelbert nor good Laird Delavore. They have sailed in at the behest of Laird Panlamaris the Bold, leader of Palmeristan, who seeks to enlist them in the united effort against foul Ethelbert and his swarthy minions.
To bribe them, you mean?
They will be compensated in coin, yes. And through the work of the Brothers of the Chapel of Precious Memories, God given magic to heal their blistered feet and the many wounds brought back from weeks of toil at sea. It is the least we can offer to goodly Laird Delavore in his struggles against the southern filth that is Laird Ethelbert.
Callan had barely closed the door to the room the three rented at a Palmeristown inn when Branson grabbed up his gemstone and strapped it to his forehead under his black silken mask.
Privateers. Mercenaries.
What are you thinking?
My guess is that my husband has decided that our load of booty is too dangerous to keep saddlebagged over Port Dooley.
I had thought to spread the wealth to the common folk about the region, but I feared that some of the jewels would be recognized. I've no desire to bring that pain to anyone. The same pain that both of you felt at the hands of Laird Pridey when I passed the stolen necklace to Kaedale.
You need not remind me of that. Did I not bid you to throw the stolen coins and jewels into the river and be done with them?
And now I intend to do something along those very lines.
By taking the treasures to the privateers and bidding them to double-cross Laird Delavore. So you'd throw in with Ethelbert?
I care not if they all kill each other. But there is a delicious irony in using that fool Yezelnik's treasures to buy off Laird Delavore's intended allies.
As delicious as the stork becoming a hero of the land against the interest of the lairds?
Branson finished dressing in the black outfit his mother had brought from Bear, finishing by tying the torn strip of fabric over the distinctive birthmark on his one bare arm.
The privateer captains might be ashore.
I will find them.
The highwaymen found the docks nearly deserted, with only a couple of slaves swabbing the planks half-heartedly, and with no dockmasters to put whips to their backs. Branson paid them little heed as he moved through the shadows along the wharves to the smaller docks and the tiny boats. He secured one without incident and floated out from the wharf, gently paddling as the current caught him and dragged him along. That current took him toward the moored privateers, for the tide was receding in the gulf. He kept glancing back over his shoulders, locating the dark silhouette of a mast protruding into the night sky, and appropriately angled his oars, drifting slowly, slowly, and in no hurry whatsoever. He brought the rowboat up against the mooring line and tied it off there, then gathered up his bags and, with a quick check to ensure that his precious sword remained secure in its sheath, the highwayman began his climb. A few moments later, he came over the rail, dark as night, and carefully paced about the deck, seeking sentries and the general lay of the ship. He'd never before been on a ship and had never even seen one up close. It took a lot of his concentration to resist losing himself in the experience, for truly this craft was a work of art, so sleek and beautiful and ultimately functional. He studied the many ropes, climbing and disappearing into the mass of rigging. Many generations of sailors had perfected this design one rope at a time, he understood immediately, recognizing in general fashion the evolution that had led from simple, single-mast boats to this intricate and wondrous three-sail design. He found a raised cabin aft and quickly discerned that the man inside carried great authority and was likely the captain of the vessel himself. Or herself, Branson realized, as he sidled up to a small window beside the forward-facing door and peeked in. She stormed about a decorated desk, a rolled parchment in hand, a red bandana tight around her head, with dark brown tresses flowing out behind and halfway down her back. She wore a puffy white blouse gathered about her slim waist and unbuttoned far enough down to be quite revealing with her every sudden turn. Black breeches and high boots completed her outfit, along with a dirk on her right hip, a curved sword on her left. She was not an unattractive woman, surely, and carried about her an aura of competence and danger.
5 months a sailing, 5, and feeding a full crew and 100 hungry soldiers to boot, and that through a gulf full of powries. Ere you seen a powry boy? Nasty little red cap, hungry to open your belly and tug out your guts. Might that he'll eat him right there while you what?
She stopped and stared, mouth agape.
Do go on. I admit that my own experiences with the wretched powries are rather limited, but from what I've seen, I'll not
The woman drew out her sword and leaped for him, thrusting for his throat. But his own sword appeared in his hand. She kept coming and reached for her dirk, but there, too, he beat her to the quick, and the sailor gasped at an empty sheath. The highwayman held her stolen dagger up before her astonished eyes. He edged the privateer back at the point of her own dirk.
Good lady, you have no fight with me.
He flipped the dagger, catching it by its tip, and presented it back to the sailor. She stared at him for many heartbeats before grabbing the presented hilt and yanking the dirk back from the intruder. She presented both her blades in a defensive stance as she continued to size up the stranger, clearly unsettled. The highwayman calmly replaced his sword in its sheath across his back, and the privateer seemed all the more frazzled.
Who ye be?
An independent rogue, much akin to yourself, I would expect.
You're to lead with insults?
Hardly, m'lady. I hold my head with pride and would expect no less from you and the worthy sailors of these fine ships. Ships flying under the flag of neither Ethelbert nor Delaval.
We're in Palmorish Town, which is thrown in with Laird Delaval.
No doubt because Laird Delaval has shown the deeper pockets.
The woman tilted her head back and narrowed her eyes.
Or because you believe that he will win out in the end and see a brighter future for those who do not oppose him. In either event, I salute you. I hold nothing but respect for any who can thrive in these dark times. I hope you will come to see me equally worthy of your respect.
As he finished, he pulled the saddlebags off his shoulder and tossed them at the privateer's feet. The woman hooked her saber under the flap of the nearest bag and with a deft flick of her wrist, severed the tie and pulled open the flap in a single fluid movement. A few coins rolled out, and several jewels showed. And despite her best efforts, the woman's eyes flashed with obvious interest.
If you came to bargain, what a fool you'd be to lay out the ante openly and with yourself surrounded by potential enemies. What army serves ye?
I am independent, and I offer no threat to accompany my gift to you, good lady. I came here to present you with these coins and jewels stolen from the castle of the Laird of Delaval himself.
The woman glanced at her crewman, who, throughout this entire ordeal, hadn't even moved. Nor did he notice his captain's look, fixated as he was on the marvelous and surprising intruder.
You would be wise to keep them hidden while you remain on the river, or even in the gulf. Delaval has sent word far and wide to find these, no doubt.
You mean to push the burden of them onto me?
If you do not want them, lady.
I said no such thing.
The highwayman smiled wider.
And what are you asking in return for this gift?
Nothing. They are indeed a burden to me as I remain in Delaval's lands.
You would have us sail you to the reaches of Laird Ethelbert?
At another time, perhaps. I have business remaining here, though I do hope to reach Entel and beyond, all the way to Bear in the near future. Should we meet again when my business is complete, I would beg of you to consider providing such passage.
And for now?
I would beg of you to hoist your sails and be gone from this place.
Hey, ye be an agent of Ethelbert indeed, then.
Independent. Truly so. I care for neither of the feuding lairds, nor for any of their lackey lessers. If all the nobles of all of Haunts are murdered in their sleep tomorrow, I will raise a glass in celebration. But of now, it is Laird Delaval who has most aggravated me, and it does me pleasure indeed to stick pins into his sides, first by robbing his treasury, and then...
By buying off 3 ships he has employed for his efforts.
The treasure is an offer of truce from another independent, perhaps a prepayment for services needed some time hence. But I hold you to nothing at all. I come in salute. Better that one such as you possesses the coins and jewels than to have me bury them in a hole. How should I ever live with myself if these treasures find their way into the hands of an innocent and oblivious peasant who is then hanged by Delaval's people for possessing them? Here, I know, they are in competent hands of men and women wise enough to keep them safe and secret. So yes, I beg you to relieve me of my burden.
The privateer looked down at the bags again, licking her lips as she imagined the treasures within. If the hints showing on the open edge were any indication, she knew that this might well be the most profitable day of her life. She slid her weapons away and lifted her eyes to regard the highwayman, but he was already gone from her cabin.
It is an amazing transformation.
Callan spoke early the next morning. Branson had just awakened and was still rubbing the sleep from his eyes. Beside him, on the small bed, Kaedale hardly stirred other than to bury her face in her pillow against the intrusion of daylight.
I did not know that you had been here before.
Of course I have not. I'm only echoing the words of the townsfolk. Palmaris Town has seen a great shift in the last few months. No Samhastes remain in the city, and there are few in the surrounding countryside by all accounts, and even the people here fast abandon the ways of the ancient ones.
The Abelicans have the gemstones in the favor of the lairds across all of Hans.
But the change is coming more quickly here than elsewhere, even than in Delaval itself from what I could see. I had no such expectation since Palmaris Town is on the border of the wilderness, across the river's land untouched by the Abelicans, by all accounts.
And land unwanted by the Samhastes, likely.
Or perhaps the Samhastes are out there, just across the river, watching and biding their time.
Perhaps the world will become a better place as the Samhastes recede into the shadows. Not that I expect much better from the Abelicans.
If they're not killing people, it will be an improvement. Did your tryst go well?
I believe it did.
Those ships are from Bergenbel, the one holding south of the gulf that hasn't thrown in for either Ethelbert or Delaval. Both sides value that port, I am told, and so they pay dearly for the services of the privateers who had taken up the mercenary cause.
Each believes that to be the path towards securing the holding, likely.
Callan nodded her agreement with the assessment.
Then my visit with the flagship captain last night might prove more irritating to Delaval than I intended.
Later that day, on a hill on the northeastern section, they watched the Bergenbel privateers raise their sails and glide away from Palmaris Town, heading north toward the open waters of the Gulf of Corona. At a nearby smithy, where they sold old Dooley, they found confirmation that the departure of the ships was the talk of the town, with many whispering that it would prove a harbinger for disaster.
Ethelbert's bought them!
The blacksmith was a hulking giant of a man with a red face and hair black and matted.
Words are that they might have been spies from the Dog, come here to survey Palmaristan's defences.
You are expecting an attack?
Preparing for it. Who's to know what the Dog Ethelbert will do? King Delaval's got him squeezed to the Mirianic.
They let it go at that, with Kaedale handing Branson, in stork guise, over to Callan and saying her farewells to Dooley. They were some distance from the smithy on an open stretch of ground reserved for visiting caravans before any of them dared broach the subject.
Just as you had hoped.
Branson grabbed the soulstone in his pouch and clutched it tightly.
If there are only a way for me to let Delaval know that it was the idiot Yezelnik's coin that bought off his privateers, my satisfaction would be complete.
It's early in the day. You will think of something.